believe it or not, we may actually finish the book. May. Yeah. Wait and see. Yeah. We are at the end of the story. We're in Perek Chafal of chapter 21. We are up to Pasuk Yud Zayin, sentence 17. A little bit of a review since I had to cancel for last week. We're in this chapter, we're dealing with the problem of how to save the tribe of Binyamin. Right? Saving tribe of Benjamin, as it were. In Perek Chaf, in chapter 20, we had the war against Binyamin, and we learned in the beginning of Perek Chaf Aleph, the beginning of chapter 21, if people could silence their cell phones, that would be perfect. Thanks for the reminder. We saw in the beginning of Perek Chaf Aleph that there had actually been an oath sworn by the tribes, by all the Shvatim, saying, well, two oaths we learned about. One oath was that we will not marry off our daughters to Binyamin, and oath number two, that whoever fails to join us in the effort against Binyamin, we view them as collaborators, and we are going to go to war against them and wipe them out as well. So they succeed in their war against Binyamin on their third attempt, and they are so inflamed by their loss in the first two that they go overboard. At least that was one read. We saw a few different approaches. But that was one read for why they did what they did to Binyamin, which is they burned down their cities. They destroyed the population. The only ones who survived this war against Binyamin were 600 soldiers who fled out into the Midbar, out into the wilderness. And we talked about these 600 and how the Jews seem, at least according to some of the Mefarshim, some of the commentators, the Jews take this as a sign that Hashem wants Binyamin to survive, because their response when they see what they've done is such horror. Like, can it be we'll lose a tribe? And we ask, well, maybe that's what happens, and we give different explanations for why they thought losing a tribe would be so terrible, but they felt it can't be. We have to make sure that that Binyamin survives. And so they said, well, we need wives for them, but we can't give them our daughters, so what are we going to do? Well, first, we're going to go to war against Yavesh Gilad, because Yavesh Gilad failed to join us in our efforts. So we'll go to war against them, we wipe them out, and we take their women who are betulot, who hadn't been with a man, and we're going to give them to Binyamin. We asked the question, why only those? What about the women who had? And we suggested the parallel to the story of the war against Midian, where that was what they did, where those were the only ones who survived. That was one explanation. We give a few different explanations at the time. But they end up with 400 such women from Yavesh Gilad, which is good. You've taken care of 400 out of the 600. The problem is that you still have 200 left who need wives. And so what we're going to see here is their attempt to take care of the other 200. Take a look, please, in Perek Chaf Aleph, chapter 21, Pasuk Tet Zayin, sentence 16, which is after they have taken care of the 400 for whom they have wives. And, you know, I mean, in general, the last five prakim of the book, right, starting with chapter 17 and 18, where we had Pesel Micha, Micha's idol, right? Remember, we've talked about when they took place, and we talked about why they might be moved here from where they took place chronologically. The emphasis on Ein Melech B'Yisrael, there is no king. These stories here, these two stories, show the Jews at their absolute worst. The first two chapters of it, the story of the idol of Micha, basically were comical, in the sense that people just do bizarre things, strange things, funny things. I mean, the Levi who's migrating through and looking for work and ends up being a Kohen is just for idolatry. All right, fine. And then the people of Dun who come through and then they offer him an upgrade and he can be for a Shevet instead of being just, you know, just for them, and the whole business with the money from his mother and making the idol, and he serves God, but he doesn't serve. God's going to be so happy I have a Levi as a Kohen. Granted, it's for idolatry. The whole story is just bizarre, but more funny bizarre, if you can say that about, you know, Jews worshipping Avodah Zarah. There's something wrong with that sentence. But but then you get to Pelegesh Begiva and the story of the concubine, and that's just horrific. from the beginning, right? The business about the turning her over to the people there who want to abuse them in Giv'a, and then the civil war in which they're going to wipe out and nearly do wipe out Binyamin. This bit at the end with the last 200 wives sort of veers back towards the funny, not in the sense that it was at all funny for the people involved, but in the sense that you look at it and you think, wow, we're really dumb people. Like, if there were, like, an R-rated version of Chelm, like what happens in Chelm, that's what you're going to see in this story. It's just like, you can't believe that people actually came up with this idea and thought it made any sense. Like, there was no plan B. Like, you'll, as you'll see, for those who have read ahead, don't spoil it, but, like, you know what I'm talking about already. So, Vayomaru, Pasuk Ted Zion, sentence 16. Vayomaru, and they said, Yerushas Pleitala Binyamin. I'm sorry, I was going to jump back to Tet Zayin to get us going. Sentence 16, sorry. Vayamru Ziknei Ha'eda. The elders say, Mavla Na'aseh Lano Sarim L'Nashim. What are we going to do for the other 200, for them to marry? Kinish Midami Binyani Binyamin Isha. There are no women left in Binyamin. Vayomaru, and they said, and the general approach is that this is the people responding to the elders. It's not the elders speaking again, it's the people responding to the elders. But there are three different ways that you can read what they said. Yushas pleita levinyamin, velo yimachet shevet mi Yisrael. Literally, the words mean the inheritance or conquering, depending on how you take the word Yerusha, of the pleita, of the refugees, for Binyamin, and the tribe shall not be erased from Israel. I don't know what that sentence meant. Some people here have English translations, right? TK, what is the art scroll? You have the art scroll. What does the art scroll say? On 17.
The inheritance of the remnant of Benjamin must survive and let the tribe not be eliminated from Israel.
Right. So our scroll takes, as it always does, Rashi. And Rashi says, Yerushat Pleita, Rashi is like the Gemara on this, as we'll see. But Rashi's view is that it's talking about the land that belongs to Binyamin. Yerushat Pleita means the land that they were supposed to inherit. And they're chiming in with the question of the elders, is the way Rashi takes it. They're agreeing with the elders in their question. And what they're saying is, how can we make sure that Binyamin doesn't lose their portion? After all, we don't have the ability to marry off our daughters to them. Continue in Pasuk Yechet, sentence 18. V'anachnu lo nuchal laseis lahem nashim mi b'noseinu. We can't give them women from our daughters. Kinish be'u b'nei Yisrael emor arur noseini shalev Binyamin. Because they had sworn, saying, accursed is somebody who gives his wife to Binyamin. So what are we, his daughter to Binyamin as a wife, I should say. So take a look at Rashi. It's in source number 3 on your sheet. Rashi spells it out that he's talking about the land. He says, Nachalas Hashevet Nishara Rekanit. The portion of the tribe is empty. Havoitza Sheolidu Banim Vyachziku Banachalasam HaPleita Nisharas. So give some idea such that the Pleita, the remnant, will be able to hold on to the land. Velo yimachet shevet mi Yisrael, and a tribe will not be eliminated from Israel. That's one read of it. They're agreeing with the elders. The elders have pointed out, we still don't have a solution for the 200. And the people are saying, yeah, we have to protect the land of that group. Radak has a similar idea when he writes. You see it here in source number 4. He says Yerushat Pleita doesn't mean the land, it means the existence of the tribe. But it's the same idea. He says, Tzarich Shetiyah Yerushat Pleita LeBinyamin. There has to be a remnant, a Yerushah of a remnant. I didn't translate the word Yerushah, because again, I don't like translating it as inheritance. It's not really an accurate read. But there has to be a remnant that will survive for Binyamin.
Like a birthright. Maybe like a birthright.
Maybe. V'lo yimachet shevet mi Yisrael. And a tribe shall not be eliminated. V'tam Yerushat. What do you mean Yerusha? Ki Yerusha hi miYaakov Avinu lihios b'banav shnei masar shvatim ad olam. The Yerusha, whatever this is, this continuity of the nation from from Yaakov is that there are supposed to be 12 tribes. So either way, Rashi, that it's about the land surviving, or Radak, it's about the existence of the tribe surviving, and by the way, Ralbag and Abarbanel are similar to Radak, the idea is that they are agreeing with the elders. But that's not the only way to read this line.
Yerusha can also be continuation.
Yeah, I was thinking about it as continuity. In this context, I think that works. The problem is that Yerusha is associated with Lareshet, which is often to conquer. So it's a harder thing to...
Reshet is something that continues.
Reshet as a network. I mean, there's also the word Rosh, which refers to somebody who is indigent. Yerusha, you make somebody indigent by taking their property. I don't know.
Yeah, we're only talking about the 200 right now? Because
yes.
The truth is, with the 400 left, the tribe will not be erased, according to Radak. I mean, I know the 200 will be Nebuch for them, but there's still going to be a tribe from the other one. You know, like,
and if they wait long enough, why is it only girls from
right.
400?
Right.
Well, I mean,
right.
But they only had one.
Right. You have to keep in mind. Yeah, you have to keep in mind that there are two concerns here that won't address. Right. Concern number one is 400 is a small population to start with, and it will take a long time for them to multiply, and there's a risk. There's a plague, something happens, who knows?
It's the same amount of land we're talking about. Like,
and that's the second concern.
Yeah.
You have a normal size shaven portion for a tiny population, they're not going to hold the land.
Right.
Enemies can invade, animals can take over, who
and
knows?
No one's going to come
attack
them because they just fought against everyone else.
Yeah, they're not exactly on the best terms right now.
The difference between 400 and 600 isn't that such a, you know...
50% more. I mean, I'd rather they have 6,000,
right.
But, you know, take what you can get.
Is, right, better than
yeah, that's the... But that's all within one take. Anyone have a translation that reads this differently, that doesn't read it as supporting the elders' question? Yerushalayim is split between Binyamin and Yehuda.
And it's part of the land of Binyamin.
They're the northern part of Binyamin. Northern part of Yerushalayim, I should say. But of the translations that you have here, because I see a few represented.
Of the 17?
Of 17. Is it?
Mine says, and they said, there must be an inheritance for them that be escaped of Binyamin, that a tribe be not destroyed out of Israel.
Okay, so that's more or less like what Rashi had and Radak had. It's supporting it. That's what you have also. Yeah, okay. So I'll give you a couple of other ways to read it. The Gemara reads it as offering a solution to the problem. The Gemara also reads Yerushat Pleita as the land. But take a look at source number one on your sheet. Gemara in Bava Basra. Vayomru Yerushat Pleita leBinyamin v'limachesh shevet miYisrael. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Devei Rabbi Ami. Rabbi Yitzchak from the yeshiva of Rabbi Ami explained. Milamed, this teaches, Shehitnu al Shevet Binyamin Shalo Tirash Bat Haben Im Ha'akin. It's a specific rule that they created for this group. Normally, the rule is that if there are no sons, then daughters inherit land, right? The general rule is that because you're dealing with patrilineal tribal identity, that the tribal identity goes with the father, therefore land has to be inherited by the male. Because otherwise, tribes will lose their land, right? You end up with a situation in which tribal land will be a patchwork. Let's say you had the land of Naphtali here, right? And then daughters and sons inherit equally, and then the daughters go marry among other tribes. Since their tribal identity of their kids will be with their husband, you will end up putting holes in Binyamin. In Naphtali, every time a daughter inherits, right? There's a family with four kids. They have two sons and two daughters, right? So the two sons get half the land. The two daughters get the other half. Leave aside firstborn. It doesn't matter for our purposes. But the two daughters are going to inherit land. One daughter marries someone from Zebulun and has kids. Her kids are Zebulun kids. That means that they're going to now have a portion in the middle of Naphtali. The other one, you know, marries who knows, from Asher or whatever it is. Your shame at fault, your tribe falls apart. You need to have the land go with the male. However, there is a rule. If there are no sons, then it goes to the daughters. That goes back to the daughters of Tzvachad. So there is a way. In fact, it'll be more rare that there will only be daughters and no sons, but it happens. And so you will have the Shevet portion fall apart to a certain extent in that way, which normally isn't a big deal. Yeah.
God had to marry their people from the same family.
So in the first generation, in the end of Sefer Bamidbar, we're told that there was a complaint, there was a concern. Wait a minute, we're going to lose our land. And so the rule was made that they have to marry within their own Sheva, but the Gemara says that's only that first generation. That doesn't continue beyond that. So
couldn't they, if they married someone from another tribe, couldn't they bring the husband to their land?
Well, that's the thing. Once you start with patrilineal tribal identity, you can't break it. And realistically,
but you can't
be mutual. It can't be mutual. In other words, what are you going to do?
Couldn't they have two children?
No, but you can't have two tribal identities. Your tribe is either this one or your tribe is that one. Once tribal identity matters
tribal,
to you...
You can't be like tribal.
Correct. Yeah. Once you have tribal identity that matters, you're stuck. You know, you need to say families are going to determine it this way or families are going to determine it that way. There's no such thing as hyphenating your tribal name. We are Naphtali Ashers. It doesn't work that way. So that's your problem. Right off the bat, that's your issue that you have to face. And normally, it's not a big deal. Meaning, even if occasionally daughters are going to inherit, so fine. It'll be a little bit here and there. It doesn't happen often enough for them to be scared of it. Other than that initial generation with Benot Slavchad, where they said if any daughters inherit, they have to marry from their shevet. However, that's a particular concern here. Because imagine the scenario, right? You're worried about them holding the land. Someone from Binyamin has such a situation in which they die and leave behind only daughters. Now this land is going to leave the Shevet. And potentially it's a very large swath because you only have 600 people in the first place, 600 families in the entire tribal portion.
They can take over the whole
land? Yeah. They're going to divide up. What else are they going to do? So the Gemara says here they made a rule. The rule that they made was that the following circumstance. They didn't make a rule for a case in which there are all daughters. If there are all daughters, the daughters inherit the land. That's true. However, they made the following rule. Let's say there are, get into inheritance law a little bit. Hypothetical situation. Family has three sons. They get older. They have their own families. One of those sons has daughters and no sons. So there are three sons, one of them only has daughters. That son passes away before his parents. Rahman al-Islam. But that son passes away before his parents do. On the day that the inheritance from the parents passes to these three sons, son number one inherits, son number two inherits, son number three, his daughters inherit in his place. That's the way it works. Is that in the event that children predecease the parent, their children, if they exist, will receive what was supposed to be their portion. So with that in mind, take a look back at this Gemara now and you understand what the Gemara is talking about. They set a condition for the tribe of Binyamin that a son's daughter would not inherit with her uncles, with the brothers of her father who had deceased. That's correct. They won't get the land. They'll be supported by the family, because otherwise, if they get the land, the result is going to be that when they get married, the land's going to leave the Shevet. The land's going to leave the tribe.
They only inherit.
Daughters can inherit from the father in the event that there are no other siblings. But in this case, where there are uncles who can get it, then the uncles will get the land, and they just have to support their nieces. That's the way it'll.
Until
they get married, and then they have whatever
the
they're getting. They're going to another normal tribe anyway. At that point, they can't wait to get out of Binyamin.
Slavchad didn't have any brothers.
So there actually is, and he has a portion from that from the brother, according to the Gemara.
You mean uncles?
No,
the right. No, but Slavchad.
The
man.
Yeah.
The Slavchad had a brother too.
Yeah, which is who Slavchad actually survived, and Slavchad therefore had a portion from him that went to his daughters as well.
There are more.
He's also a firstborn. Like there's a whole thing in the Gemara and Bava Basra. He had like five different portions of land. But the point for us is, daughters normally will inherit. If a man from Binyamin only has daughters, they will inherit. But in the event that he has sons and daughters, or in the event that he has sons, and one of those sons only leaves behind daughters, then the inheritance will not go to those, the inheritance will go among the sons in order to maximize retention of land. So the
but
way
only
that
with Binyamin.
Only with Binyamin. That's just because of the situation.
And only for this generation.
That we don't know.
That's what I was asking. This generation that can still have.
Right. We don't know. Well, it's clearly beyond the first generation because the story requires two generations and it doesn't make any sense.
Why does it end?
Right. We are not told. We are not told.
Those 600 that were left, they're not going to have brothers. They're probably just one from
No, it's among their kids. We have no idea what their family breakdown was. But this is talking about among their kids. They have children, and those children have children, and that's where this becomes relevant.
Second generation, yeah.
Yes. So so that's the way the Gemara reads this, is that when they're saying Yerushat Pleitala Binyamin, what they're actually trying to say is, this is the way that Binyamin will survive. Here's an enactment for the sake of the inheritance of the land of Binyamin. That's a second way to read it. The last way to read it is Mitzudat David. Mitzudat David says that they're actually denying there's any problem. Take a look again back at the Pasuk. At sentence 17. Vayomaru, the nation responded to the elders. The elders said, what are we going to do for the other 200? So they said, Yerushat Pleitah leBinyamin. They said, what do you mean? There is a remnant for Binyamin. You have the women from Yavesh Gilad. They were given to Binyamin. V'lo yimach hashevet miYisrael. A tribe is not going to be wiped out. And besides, v'anachu lo nuchal noseis lam nashim ibnoseinu. We can't give our daughters to them to marry. That doesn't work because they had already sworn against giving the them. So that's another way to read it. It's Mitzvah David in number two. Heshivu kol ha'edah v'amru halo Yerushas ha'pleitam yavesh gilad heima v'sulos she'echiyu halo le'binyamin v'sonum. They said, what? We already did it. We gave Yerushas ha'pleitah doesn't mean Binyamin. Yerushas ha'pleitah means the remnant of Gil of Yavesh Gilad. The remnant of the people we killed in Yavesh Gilad, those are the girls we handed off to Binyamin. And if so, as he continues to say, the tribe won't be wiped out. We're good. We got it covered. To which the elders respond, no, you don't. And so that brings us to Pasuk Yutes. Either with the rest of the people on board with what the elders are planning, or the rest of the people are not on board with what the elders are planning. But either way, this is the bizarre Chelm story that ends our Sefer. Vayomaru, Pasuk Yetes, sentence 19, they said, Hine, Chag Hashem b'shilo miyamim yamima, asher mitzvono leveis el mizrucha Hashemesh. There is an annual festival in Shiloh. Where is Shiloh? Or where is the festival? We'll see. Mitzvono leveis el mizrucha Hashemesh, north of Beit El, off to the east. East of the path that goes up from Beit El to Shechem, uminegev lilavona, and south of Lavona. In case you wanted to know where, this is where it is. Vayitzavu es b'nei Binyamin lemor, and they commanded Binyamin, saying, lechu va'aravtem ba'keramim. Or I could sit here. Really, the seat's okay. This is far right here. Lechuva Aravtem Bakramim. So here's the plan. The plan is, go wait in ambush in the vineyards by this festival. Uri Isem, and you're going to see, Vihine, Im Yetzu B'nos Shiloh Lechuv B'Mecholos, if it really means when, the girls of Shiloh go out to dance as part of this festival. Vitzasem min hakramim, you jump out of the vineyards. V'chatavtem lachem ish ishtom, even as Shiloh, and you can go catch a wife from the daughters of Shiloh. V'alachtem eretz Binyamin, and then go run back to Binyamin before anybody catches you. I kid you not. This was the plan. It's the reversal of. I mean, this is the most bizarre story.
Are the Shiloh girls doing?
Yeah.
Wait a second. What is that?
They're
from which tribe?
This is a general festival.
But what's going on? Because
Binyamin is going to kidnap these girls.
The men from Binyamin
are going to capture
any girl.
Shiloh. is Shiloh is, I believe, in Ephraim. It might be Menasheh, but I believe Ephraim. It's part of Yosef. I just don't remember if it's Menasheh or Ephraim in this area.
So they're related.
They're all from Rachel. But it could be this was a big festival that everybody came to.
But wasn't there another time where girls went into the...
No, that's not what we're getting. I know what you're thinking of. We're not there yet. This is their brilliant idea. We are going to save the last 200 of Binyamin. They can get married and there will be more wives from Binyamin and 50% more members of the Shevet. All you have to do is when there's this big festival and the girls go out to dance, go out and kidnap them and then you'll have wives. And no one said this is a bad idea.
They're grabbing them and running with the girls to
Binyamin. Correct.
It's a point. They're like they're taking them without their like so they don't can't willingly go.
If they come up with a plan like this, why can't they just say, well, we're going to give the girls?
Because they swore not to.
They swore not to.
They're not allowed.
They're not allowed.
They're just closing their eyes to it, basically.
Well, no, we didn't give them. They kidnapped us.
So they're suggesting it to Binyamin.
Yes.
They're telling Binyamin, you do it,
but the girls
and we'll close our eyes.
Yes.
Right? We won't do it.
They can't give
them. We won't close our eyes. It just happened. They took them.
Yeah. And we're not going to do anything about it.
We can't do anything about it. They're gone.
They're gone. Yeah, no one can find them. Oh, well.
If you go and kidnap my daughter, I'm not going to do it.
That's exactly what they said. I don't have a justification for this story. This is what happens at the end of Shoftim. This is why it keeps repeating. There was no king. People just did what they thought made sense. That's exactly what you're talking about. Yes. Yes, that's one way to look at it.
The girls had no idea they were going to be kidnapped.
Correct.
But only 200 of the girls.
Just wait, we're not done.
Well, you could have more than one wife.
Well, the men could have. Yeah, the men could have.
Okay, so let's go further here. Let's go further. Pasuk Bay, sentence 22. Vehaya, and it'll be Chiyavo. This is usually understood to be the elder still talking. There is a version of this that reads it that Binyamin is now talking, but it's generally assumed it's the elders. Vehaya Chiyavo avosama achayhem larive leinu. When their fathers or their brothers complain, because as Ruth said, who's going to go along with this, right? When they come back to us, v'amarinu aleihem. So we're going to say to them, and I'm going to read this one way, although there are multiple ways you could read the sentence, but this is the way that it's generally read by the Mefarshim, by the commentators. When they come to us, they're going to say, Chanunu osam, we had mercy on them. Kilo lakachnu ish ishto b'milchama, because we weren't able to get wives for all of them in our war with Yavesh Gilad, we were short 200. And as far as your oath, you didn't give them over. You didn't violate the oath such that you should be guilty. You're not guilty. Similar idea in Radak and Rabak. This is actually their logic.
They're assuming that their concern is going to be that they were guilty, not that our daughters were taken.
Well, the first part of it is that you're angry that they took your daughter. But look, what are you going to do? Binyamin has to survive. And as far as the oath, don't worry about it. You're not guilty.
So maybe they all were feeling kind of guilty about taking that oath. And look what it bought them into. And so we're
going to
kind of...
I don't know. I wouldn't.
Maybe it also solves a problem. I mean, if they would give them to the Binyamin voluntarily, give their daughters, there would have to be dowries and all that kind of thing. Whereas this way... If
you saved money on it.
Yeah.
Let them elope.
They don't have to make a wedding.
Cheap.
Right. I don't know. Look, if it works for you.
Given that this whole incident started because of the mistreatment of a woman,
yes, but that's exactly the point. They've learned nothing. That's exactly the point. They have learned nothing.
Well, are women just not seen as the same? I mean, women are a lower.
Yeah, we're looking
time anywhere, aren't they? Are they not
21st century
possession?
No, but
to women as
but,
well.
But when you look back in Tanakh, and this was one of the major messages that we saw throughout Sefer Shoftim, it was that the women of Israel are supposed to be different from the women of the nations around. So we had, Devorah, and we had Yael, however you understand her identity. We talked about that, whether she's Jewish or not. We had Shimshon's mother, Haslaponi. Right? We kept highlighting the conduct of the women among the Jews, and contrasting it with Delilah, right? It's Shimshon's wife versus Shimshon's mother, right? Which is a classic thing. But you had it also with the mother of Sisera contrasted with Devorah and Yael in Shiraz Devorah. We showed that it's supposed to not be this way among us. We're supposed to be different. And unfortunately, the whole story, right? We noted last time, Shiloh being identified as being in the land of Canaan is not coincidental. This is what we are at this stage. We've become like everybody else, and we're waiting for Shmuel, and we're waiting for Shaul and David to try to lift us out of it. There are a lot of parallels going on. One thing that, when we start Shmuel, I'm going to point out to you, is that in the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, if you remember from the Haftorah on Rosh Hashanah, we're told that Chana and Elkanah and Pnina go to the Mishkan in Shiloh, right? This is a long shot. Do you remember what it says about how often they go and when they go? What does it say in the Pasuk?
They go on the...
They went to Hashem, Miyamim Yamima, Lachog Lifnei Hashem, Bishilo. Miyamim Yamima. How did it describe here? Chag Hashem Bishilo, Miyamim Yamima. Right? I don't think that's an accident, that turn of phrase. It's a contrast of the low that they're at here with their chag lifnei Hashem b'shilo miyamim yamim, where it's going to be to kidnap the women and so on, versus what Elkanah and Hannah do, which is bring karbanos and daven to Hashem and do what we normally think it's supposed to be when you have a chag l'Hashem b'shilo. So I think there's a lot. I'm going to use this in Shmuel also, so forget it now. That way I'll be able to tell it to you anew when we start Shmuel.
But they say yearly.
Right. Miyamim is usually understood as an annual thing. That's part of the discussion about what the Chag was that they were actually coming to Hashem for. But the same wording is used because I think it wants to highlight for us. These are the depths. This is really bad. This is not like, there's no justification for this that's going to work. It's just, it's corrupt and it's foolish. That's why I said what I said to you about how we go back towards this sort of Chelm version that we saw in Pesal Micha. Like, someone sat down and came up with this idea and a whole bunch of people said, that sounds like a good idea, let's go do it. And you don't understand, like, what are you talking about?
And just in case you didn't get it, they give you the lesson.
Well, that's where we're going. We'll get there.
Just in case you didn't get it.
Okay, let's go through and get this a little bit closer, though, in terms of what's happening here. In terms of the plan here, first of all, there are some things that are strange in this story that I think are important to catch. No, I don't mean the whole story. I mean particular notes. Go back to where we started here in Pasuk Yates, right? What's strange about sentence 19, Pasuk Yates?
Why are they describing where Shiloh is? And they did that before also this past few...
Well, that was when we said it was in Eretz Canaan.
Eretz Canaan, right?
Right? But then we said the point may be to say it's in Canaan. Why do you need to tell me where Shiloh is? That's where the Mishkan is.
Yeah, obviously not going there.
Yeah.
So there are two ways that I would offer you two answers.
Wasn't there another one that we talk about there being
only the Dan one for Avodah Zarah, right? That's not this. So take a look on your sheet at source number six. Source number six is Radak's approach. He says, "Va'ani tama." He says, "I am surprised. Matzarech l'chol zeh. Why do you have to give all this identification for where Shiloh is? Kishilo yadua haya below simanim. They knew exactly what Shiloh was. Va'nira be'inai ki achag haya b'shilo. So it appears to me that the festival was in Shiloh. Ulahodia oso hamakom zacharei lahasimanim. And it's trying to tell us where the festival is, not where Shiloh is, but where this particular party goes on. The Karmei Shiloh, while you smuchim lezamakom, the vineyards of Shiloh were near the place that was identified." That's one possibility. Yeah.
But your GPS.
However, Professor Yecheskel Kaufman goes closer to what Tova said in source number 7. He says the answer is they weren't going to the Mishkan. Remember, this story, according to most commentators, occurs in the beginning of the period of the Shoftim, not the end, right after Yahushua. So he says, Mikdash Shiloh nasem eforsam besof tkufa shoftim. He says the temple of Shiloh, the Mishkan, only becomes well known at the end of the period of the Shoftim. We have it in Shmuel, right, with Eli and all that. Aval ein zechel appears sumo brishis kufas haShoftim. We have no sign that it was well known at the beginning of the period of the Shoftim. In fact, if you do a word search in the book of Shoftim, you will find Shiloh only shows up in the story of Micha and in this story. You don't find it discussed at all among the other Shoftim. Now, we do find there's some confusion in this regard, because because we do find references to Beit El, and we've said maybe Beit El was Shiloh. That's not at all clear. But this would be consistent with a comment that the Medrash makes, again, to refer you to Sefer Shmuel. It's consistent with a comment that's made in the Medrash there, that when Elkanah and Hannah used to go with Penina to the Mishkan in Shiloh, they used to try to bring other people with them because no one else was going. So that fits what you're saying over here. They need directions to know how to get there because people aren't going to the Mishkan and Shiloh at this point. That's where the people have fallen. Could be. So they have this festival that they're going to make. So here we need to ask ourselves a question. Take a look at source number 5 now. This is the mission at the end of Tanis. Others have already referenced this, but now we get to see it. The mission at the end of Tanis decides to tell us, after telling us about the tragedies of the 17th day of Tammuz, the tragedies of the 17th day of Tammuz and of Tisha B'Av, it then tells us about two great days on the Jewish calendar. One is the 15th of Av, and the other is Yom Kippur. And here's the text. Lo hayu yamim tovim liYisrael kachamisha asar ba'av uchiyom haKippurim. There were no great days like those two on our calendar, the 15th day of Av and Yom Kippur. Shebahen benos Yerushalayim yotzos bechleila van shu'ulin. On those days, the daughters of Jerusalem would go out wearing borrowed white clothing. Shalovayesh is misha'elo. It was borrowed so that you wouldn't embarrass somebody you didn't have. Everybody was wearing somebody else's. That's the idea. And these girls would dance in the vineyards. And what did they say? Bahur, young man, see what you are choosing. Don't look at beauty. You should look to family. And as the Mishnah and then the Braisa there in the Gemara go on, it talks about how each one would say, I am special because of X, and they would actually meet their intended on that day. That was how they did it back in the day. You want to know how they did it? There are no shadchanim in this picture.
Men being told to look at women.
Yes. Well, that makes sense. Men aren't dancing. They're just watching. That's correct.
Well, that's an honest thing.
We're not supposed to divert their eyes.
They're supposed to actually look at them. But that's when they're not married.
Actually, it's interesting they said, look at us, and yet don't look at beauty.
Yeah. Well, sana'inecha is sort of a common phrase for pay attention.
Yeah.
It isn't necessarily...
Is that all the
I wouldn't take it that way. Sorry?
Is that all the girls? I mean, not all the girls from Israel.
I would assume not. I would assume not, but we are not given enough information. But now think about this story in terms of what we're reading here, and tell me how these two pieces of the jigsaw puzzle fit together.
They're all different.
Well, they're not here. The girls come out
Correct. Voluntarily. They're not being kidnapped. That's nice. Made progress.
No, the girls come voluntarily.
But the question I have is, how do these two stories fit together? And you know, when you're learning in yeshiva and you're learning Gemara, you often don't know the end of Sefer Shoftim because in school they don't do Pilegish. I remember vaguely actually that they did say something about it, but it wasn't in full detail, and we definitely did not get to the end. So you often read about Tu B'Av and this festival and don't have any idea that it's connected to what's going on in Tanakh, but clearly it is. I mean, it isn't random that you have girls going out and having a festival and dancing, and then in one case they're being kidnapped for brides, and in the other case they're actually recruiting men to marry them, right? Someone mentioned last time Sadie Hawkins. It's not quite Sadie Hawkins, because they're not chasing the men, they're just luring the men.
When did Tu B'Av get?
So that's the big question. That's exactly the question. So the Radak's view is that the Tu B'Av celebration was old. First of all, Radak's view, and this is the simple read of the Mishnah as well, is that this was not done only on Tu B'Av. They did this on Yom Kippur.
Yeah.
That this happened. Look at the language of the Mishnah. Shebahen, on those days. Right? You don't have to read it that way. It could be this was only Tu B'Av, because they go on to say what's wonderful about Yom Kippur is not the wedding stuff. What's wonderful on Yom Kippur is getting kapara, getting forgiveness from Hashem. And then they go on to talk about what happened. happened on Tuvah historically and why it should be viewed as a great day. Remember that one of the things we mentioned, we talked about this, one of the reasons to celebrate Tuvah is that that was when they made the decree that now other tribes could marry into Binyamin, that the oath they had sworn was only for the first generation. So there's already a Tuvah connection to this story, from before. But Radak's read is that we were doing this celebration already back in the period of the Shoftim. Take a look at Radak in source number 8.
Where is this? When and what period was this?
This Mishnah? Well, in the Mishnah, what the Mishnah is describing is a practice they're familiar with, which would be end of the Second Temple. You're talking about 2,000 years ago. But we don't know when it started.
In terms of what this happened. Was this happened first? Or?
No.
Well, we don't know. We're not told when it started. Remember, in the days of the Mishnah, no one is sitting down and writing history. There wasn't something that Jews generally engaged in. No one is sitting down and saying, this happened in this year. It wasn't a popular thing to do. Professor Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi of Columbia University wrote a work called Zachor, which is remarkable and very worthwhile. It's in English. And in the introduction, he talks about how Jews are more focused on memory than on history. It's about what you live and what relates to you, as opposed to just dates and locations and such. Read it. Read this introduction. I hope I'm quoting it correctly. But take a look at number 8 here, where Radak says that he believes that what we describe in the Gemara in Tan is what we saw in this Mishnah, in source number 5, was what was happening back then. He says, V'amar bo ha-targum. The Aramaic commentary to Shoftim says, Mizman lizman, on the word miyamim yamima, from time to time, mi mo'ed lim mo'ed, from mo'ed to mo'ed. So when he says mo'ed to mo'ed, mo'ed can mean appointed time, but it could also mean festival. So he says, ve'efshar, it could be, ki mi pesach le pesach hayazeh, o mi sukkot le sukkot, it could be they did it on Pesach, it could be they did it on Sukkot, shayazman simcha, it was a time of joy. O biyom haKippurim, shayu benos Yisrael yotzos v'cholos bakramim kidivrei Razal. Or it could be it was Yom Kippur, and that was when they did it. And therefore, he believes the Gemara's references to a festival they were observing back then. And that's one take. The advantage of Radak is that it makes this story consensual. Right? If you take Radak's view that this is the same festival that's going on in the Gemara as what's going on then that means that there was a festival where the women go out anyway and go looking for guys, and they're just going there in order to meet women and to be able to marry them, just without the blessing of the father and the brother. That would be one way to look at it. I think that's what Radak is doing. Fundamentally, he's redeeming the story somewhat by saying this isn't a case of kidnapping. The other way to read it is that the practice came later as a memorial to what happened here. That would be the other way to read the story. In other words, no, in the days of the Shoftim, they were not doing this. But afterwards, at some point, they said, we need to remember what happened here. We need to remember this disaster.
So why is it happening?
Well, what they're trying to do is turn it into something positive, to say, we're going to do this in a way that's not like what happened then, but it will remind us of what happened back then.
I would say to remember it. Hide the girls that day.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. What's really interesting here to me...
But you could put a good spin on it, because if that's the same as the tribe of Benjamin, then you could say it was actually a good thing and it's a cause for celebration because they weren't extinct and it helped create...
You celebrate the survival of Binyamin.
You celebrate the survival and the, you know, the unity and...
Right. Could be.
They use the word chataften. That's not a positive word.
No. It really means to grab.
Yeah.
Yes, it does. Although that's the allegation of the brother and the father. Right? That's where the word is used. When they come to complain to you and to say... No, it's v'chataftem, you will grab. I take that back. Yeah, it's true. Doesn't sound like it. But Radak is trying. Because we're bothered. I mean, you read this, and you're like, forget the fact that there's no Melech b'Yisrael, but didn't somebody have parents? Like, who thought that this was actually a bright idea? So one thing that I saw, Yechezkel Kaufman makes reference to this. I brought it for you in sources 9 and 10. I'm going to not read it all out in the text in the interest of time, because I think we can actually wrap the book this week. But apparently others read the Book of Shoftim, and either these things that you're seeing in 9 and 10 actually happened, or they just modeled their legends on it. But these are two stories. The one from Livius, the history of Rome, in source number 9, is about how when the Romans wanted wives, and they invited others to come to a festival there, and they kidnapped their daughters. And then in Herodotus, in number 10, among the Greeks, he tells you a story about the Athenians and ambushing the Athenian women in order to get them. This is not a question in terms of chronological order. We didn't get the story from them. Shoftim is written down and taken care of, before this time. But it's very interesting to see among the Romans and among the Greeks that you have these stories. Okay, bad behavior all around. Do not try this at home. So, okay. So what happened? Pasuk Chav Gimel, sentence 23. Vayasu chen b'nei Binyamin. So they did it. Binyamin did it. Vayisu nashim lemisparam. And they married women according to their number, apparently not polygamous. Mina mecholalot asher gazalu. I don't know why they didn't try polygamy at this point, if they really want to replenish the shevet, but it says according to their number. Mina mecholalot asher gazalu, from these women who were dancing, they stole these women. Vayelechu vayeshuvo nachalasam, they went back home. Vayivnu es ha'arim, they built their cities again. Vayeshuvo bahem, and they lived there. And if nothing else, the women had a lot of land. And everybody else went home. And Mitzudat David explains the value of saying everybody else went home means, and they didn't take the land of Binyamin. They each went back to his shevet, to his mishpacha, to his tribe and his family. So each one went to his portion. And then, yes, we get the closing sentence. Bayamim ha'em, the fourth time we've seen the sentence. Ein melech b'Yisrael, there was no king. Ish ha'yashar b'inav yaseh, and they just did what they thought made sense. And we've seen that off and on throughout Shoftim, meaning we saw Shimshon. Right? Which Shimshon says, he yashra be'inai, she's good in my, or tova be'inai, she's good in my eyes. We saw it with Yiftach, right? Yiftach always thinks he's doing the right thing. He fights against Ephraim because they were ungrateful for his military victory. He takes a vow, the first thing out of my house, I'm going to make a carbon, and it turns out to be his daughter. The people themselves and what they did to Yiftach. Right? Yiftach was born out of promiscuity, right, was the story. There was an Isha Zonah involved, and so they kicked him out until they needed him to defend them against Ammon, and then they invited him back. Over and over and over again in this book, it's Isha Yashar Be'inav Yaseh, people doing foolish things because they think they know what they're doing, and there's a lack of leadership to guide them. If you take a look at the last two sources I brought on the sheet, different approaches to this statement of Ish HaYashar Be'inav Yaseh. Mitzudat David actually reads it as a positive. It's hard. But he says, Im ki lo haya bayimim ha'im melech b'Yisrael. Even though they didn't have a king, v'chol echad asah ha'yashar be'inav, and each person just did what seemed right in his eyes, mikol makom lo shalchu yad b'nachamaz binyamin. Yet, they didn't take from the portion of Binyamin. Talk about a silver lining. They didn't take the land from Binyamin, even though there was no king. They still did they still did something right in this regard at any rate. Even though everybody was just doing what he thought was right, they actually, stop clock, right, twice a day. They got this right. But Abarbanel says, no, you can't save this. There's no redemption here. The Kabanasi, he says, you know what I think? Four times in these stories we said, in those days there was no king. Echad le'inyan pesal Micha, once was the idol of Micha. Asheni le'inyan b'nei Dan shalchu l'kachat Laisha, the second time when Dan went to conquer Laish from Sidon. Hashlishi le'inyan pilegesh b'giva, the third one was with the concubine, meaning introducing the story. Shizkabtu b'nei Yisrael v'nachmu Ela al Ela, they had their civil war. And Harvi'i, the fourth, Zan Isgar b'sof ha'sefer, is the one at the end of the book. Uva al inyan Yavesh Gilad, and it's referring to what happened with Yavesh Gilad, Shechrimum, that they destroyed their Benasnu Basuloseim Livnei Binyamin and gave their daughters to Binyamin. Vishezikneo Aidam, Ruhalehem, Shechtafu Benos Shiloh, and the elders said, yeah, you should go kidnap girls from Shiloh. Kol Zahaya Siba, Lafisha Loya Melech B'Yisrael. Do you want to know why this happened? It's because you didn't have a king. Ki ilu hayasham, had he been there, lo naasim osam hadvrim ba'oso ha'ofen ha'bilti mesudar. Had there been a king, they wouldn't have done it in this lawless way. So Abarbanel says, plain and simple, they were just completely lost ethically, morally, and just did what came to mind, and that's how you get this disaster.
It's interesting because I refresh my memory, but when they go and ask for a king, aren't they told this is what we're not supposed to have, and that's what the other nations have, and it's really frowned upon, but okay,
correct.
Fine. So then why is this like... It's held up such high regard. This is all because they don't have a king. Okay, so we have a king. Well, you really shouldn't.
Right. So when we get to that in Sefer Shmuel, yeah. We will find that the commentators tend to assume the problem is not asking for a king. It's the motivation. Do we want it because everybody else has it? Do we want it because it looks good? Do we want it because it'll lead us in war? Do we want it because it'll tell us, you know, what we're supposed to do? And you'll see there, we're going to go through the different ways to read their request. But if you go back into the Chumash, right, Hashem says, when you ask for a king, som tasim alachamelch, you shall place a king upon yourself. The ambivalence begins right there. And it just follows through. That's why it's always very interesting to me. When people ask the question of whether Judaism is okay with democracy, right? They say, well, isn't the natural order within Judaism that you have a king? The answer is, well, not so simple. Not simple at all. That's going to be a major theme for Sefer Shmuel, is can royalty work? You know, one of the points, since it's Parshas Emor this week, fast Emor-related thought, one of the things you see in Parshas Emor is the instruction that Kohanim cannot have a mum, cannot have a physical blemish. And you read that, and you have to ask yourself, that is so inconsistent with what the Torah tells us over and over and over again about Tzelem Elokim, right, everybody's in the image of God, about the fact that this is not a requirement for our kings, it's not a requirement for our judges, it may be on the Sanhedrin, that's its own discussion, but our Nevi'im, right, Moshe is a Kvad Peh, right, he can't speak. We're told, you know, when Shmuel goes to pick a king, right, he goes to Yishai, and he's so impressed by Yishai's oldest son, Eliav. And Hashem says to him, you're looking with your eyes. I see to the heart. It's not about how impressive he looks. And Shaul, we're told, stood head and shoulders above everybody else, right? And he's the one who doesn't last as a king. Like, why in the world are you so caught up in it? And especially when you go look at what happens to the Kohanim. We had such problems with our Kohanim. We can see in the beginning of Shmuel, Hophni and Pinchas may not have any physical blemishes, but they're awful. You know, and we see it with others, that Stukim come from the line of Kohanim. It didn't work. It didn't help. There is a notion that we're trying to accomplish something by not having the blemishes, not having the mum, but we're not living up to whatever it is that we're trying to accomplish. So then why is it that the blemish is off limits? That's its own discussion. It's a good discussion, but not for right now. Maybe if we have a minute at the end. But going back towards the king, what we're striving for is a king who's going to solve this problem. That's what we want. We want a king who is going to make sure this doesn't happen again. But not everybody is on the same page, and not all the kings are on the same page. And so we get some kings who are wonderful, right? We, you know, with all of the controversy regarding David, which we'll have to see as we go through Sefer Shmuel, at the end of the day, we look at David as one of the best. Yoshiyahu, Chizkiyahu, Shlomo is his own controversies that we have to work through. But at the same time, you also get an Achav, right? Not among the best. 50-50 maybe, according to one Gemara. You get Menashe with all of his problems, and Ammon, and it's just, I mean, we'll see. It doesn't work out. Very often it doesn't work out. But that's the idea, is the king is supposed to be the one who's going to prevent this from happening.
So what is the lesson from that?
From which?
From the fact that it doesn't work out.
That we got to try harder. You know what Jews are like. We keep beating our head against the wall, thinking it'll get a different result next time. We beat our head against the wall. We keep on trying. Yeah, but Ruth, and then Etty.
Yeah, but in this sense, every time when it says, you know, there's no king, does it necessarily mean a king with a crown on his head, or just a good leader.
So it's possible that a shofet, it's possible that a shofet had the potential but lacked the authority and the power. Like, he doesn't have a hereditary position, for example. So he lacks the power to make it happen.
But I mean, in this story, there was no shofet.
Correct.
At this time.
Correct. At this point, they got nothing. Yeah. Right.
I was in the same line, because this story is before all the shoftim. So between this story and the king, there is how many generations or how many years?
Almost nothing. Oh, you mean between this story? I'm sorry.
Yeah,
400 years. Yes.
So 400 years of shoftim.
Give or take.
Before they had
400 years, give or take.
400 years of shoftim before they had Shaul.
Roughly. Right. Remember that we learned in the story of Yiftach that Amon said, "You came into our land 300 years ago." Oh, you weren't here yet. No, you hadn't joined yet. That's right. Okay.
How many years between this and the king, first king?
Well, if you take this story as occurring in the beginning, then you're talking about roughly 400 years.
400.
Roughly. I'm not being precise. One other note. Malbim actually at the end here makes the argument also for post-dating the story, putting the story at the end of the period of the Shoftim. He sides there with what Abarbanel said was possible, and Radak was really sure that this occurred when Shimshon was held captive by the Plishtim. Just I want to make sure to note before we end. I gave you a second sheet here. The second sheet is... this sheet. Not that sheet. This one. I'll give it to you after. It's an outline of the book. I gave you at the top just a few of the major themes we've seen. God's hand manipulating history, right? The opposition between Shoftim and Esther, we talked all about that. How Hashem can win with any pieces. You have this variety among the Shoftim, and yet Hashem can use whoever is at hand, and the need for strong leadership, which we've been talking about so much in these last stories in particular. Then I tried to give you a little bit of a digest in each section of the book, just as a way to remember what we saw. Obviously, it's not everything we saw. It took us 67 weeks of classes. But hopefully this will act as something of a reminder also of what we did here within the book. Yeah, it's been a long run.
There must have been some periods during this. If the period from the beginning to the end was 400 years, there must be some periods when there weren't shoftim, but there aren't enough.
No, there are.
Unless there are some we don't know about.
No, that's right. So Abarbanel assumes we do know, and so does Ralbag and the Mefarshim. The commentators tend to assume that the line of shoftim that we have is all the shoftim that existed. And that others will disagree, but classic commentators think not. No, because we have, with some of them, it's a 40-year period. Like, again, I'm being imprecise with the 400. I don't remember the exact number, but it's 490 years from the time we get out of Egypt until the Beis HaMikdash. So knock out of that 52 years for Shmuel. Knock out of that 52 years for Shmuel, 28 years for Yoshua. You end up with roughly 400 years. All right, so next week, God willing, I think we'll do a pre-Shavuos shir instead of starting on Shmuel, because the week after that, the Thursday before Shavuos, I'm not going to be having a shir. I will be doing a shirim over Shavuos. You're more than welcome to. God willing. And then hopefully after Shavuos, we'll get started on Sefer Shmuel.
Okay.
Thank you very much.